Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, a new report says in Iraq, women are often prey. And when victims of rape, they're then often rejected, not protected, by their own families.
In Washington, the director of the CIA testifies today on Iraq and uranium, and will preview Tony Blair's visit tomorrow.
Senator Ted Kennedy demands protection for U.S. soldiers, saying they're sitting ducks in Iraq.
Also, part autobiography and part fiction, best-selling author Jonathan Safran Foer on his book, Everything is Illuminated.
I made a trip very much like the trip in the book, where I had a photograph of a woman who had been told to save my grandfather from the Nazis. And I went to the Ukraine for 3 days looking for this woman.
And what to do about dead malls?
Coming up Here and Now.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There have been more deadly attacks today in Iraq. NPR's Guy Raz in Baghdad says one attack left an American soldier dead outside the Iraqi capital.
There was an army convoy that was headed west out of Baghdad, and it was heading toward a military installation in the western Iraqi desert near the border with Jordan. At about 9 a.m. local time this morning, one of those army vehicles, it was a truck, was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade. It's unclear who fired it or where it was fired from, but the result was it killed one soldier immediately and wounded several others.
In addition, today, U.S. military officials say the mayor of the Iraqi city of Hadissa, described as pro-American, was shot and killed, along with his 8-year-old son. The assailants have been unidentified. The remnants of Hurricane Claudette are bringing heavy rains to parts of southwest and central Texas today. Residents along the Gulf Coast saw roofs torn off buildings and windows shattered. Suzanne Hogan of the Red Cross is in Port O'Connor, close to where the eye of the storm came ashore.
Mohammed's attorneys argue the attacks drew so much publicity that an impartial jury...
Almost every business and every structure has been affected in one way or another, whether it's dealing with flooding, its roofs torn off. I mean, there's nothing that's operating normally in this area, and they got quite a pounding. It came in very fast, very intense, and then passed. But I drove through that, and I truly got an education, the difference between a severe storm and a hurricane.
Two deaths are blamed on Claudette. Texas Governor Rick Perry wants President Bush to declare a federal disaster in 15 of the worst affected counties. A Virginia judge has decided to move the trial of sniper suspect John Muhammad to the city of Virginia Beach. It's 200 miles from most of the shootings. The move follows a decision by another judge to move the trial of Lee Malveaux, who is also accused in the sniper attacks. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Muhammad's attorneys argue the attacks drew so much publicity that an impartial jury could not be found in the Washington, D.C. area. Judge Leroy Millett has now agreed, saying the move is necessary to ensure a fair trial. He's moved the proceeding to Virginia Beach, a city in the southeastern part of the state, not far from Chesapeake, Virginia. That's where the trial of the other sniper suspect, Lee Malveaux, will now take place. After Malveaux's trial was moved to Chesapeake, prosecutors dropped their objections to moving the Muhammad proceedings. Muhammad's trial is scheduled to begin October 14th, Malveaux's on November 10th. Both could face the death penalty. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 63 points at 9,065. Trading is heavy. The NASDAQ Composite Index is down more than 12 points at 1740. The S&P is down 9. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, prices at the consumer level were up slightly last month. The government says its Consumer Price Index, a widely used inflation gauge, rose 0.2% in June. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The rise in consumer prices last month was the first in 3 months. However, just about all of the increase was the result of higher energy costs, especially prices for gasoline. Energy prices, which fell substantially in April and May, shot up 0.8% in June. That included a 1.3% jump in prices at the gas pump. Food prices also moved higher due to a rise in prices for fruits, vegetables, meat, and poultry. But stripping out food and energy, the so-called core rate of inflation was unchanged, showing inflation pressures affecting the economy remain relatively reined in. In an address to lawmakers yesterday, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan talked about a potentially crippling economic condition known as deflation, where prices fall and keep falling. However, Greenspan said he still thinks chances of that happening are remote. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
Bankrupt insurance and financial company Conseco has filed another plan to reorganize. This is the fourth one offered so far. Creditors have argued with Conseco as they try to recoup as much as they can in bankruptcy court. Conseco is expected to emerge from bankruptcy, but only as an insurance company. Its bankruptcy is the third largest on record, just behind WorldCom and Enron. Contract talks have opened between the United Auto Workers and Daimler Chrysler. Negotiators shook hands and smiled before beginning talks in a Detroit suburb today. The UAW and negotiators for the automakers will spend several weeks nailing down a new agreement that covers 300,000 workers. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Post-war challenges in Iraq are being felt both in-country and on Capitol Hill. CIA Director George Tenet is expected to testify before a Senate panel today on pre-war intelligence. And Senator Ted Kennedy is demanding the Bush administration present a post-war plan to prevent U.S. troops from being, as Kennedy called them, sitting ducks. We begin in Iraq, where a U.S. soldier was killed today in a grenade attack on a convoy outside Baghdad. And in the northern town of Hattaf, the pro-American mayor and his son were also shot dead, killings considered a warning to those who would support the new Iraq. Also today, a report by Human Rights Watch that says rapes are on the rise in post-war Iraq. Neela Banerjee is a correspondent for The New York Times. She joins us on the line from Baghdad. And Neela, what are you hearing about this increase in rapes?
Well, I've been here since early May, and literally, you know, the first day on the ground, you heard about these rumors of women being abducted and raped in Iraq, and that this was an entirely new phenomenon that came about after the end of the war and sort of the end of security on the streets in Baghdad. And you try to separate rumor from fact, but the sense that you get is that there probably is an increase in abduction and rape, though I'm not saying it's an epidemic proportions.
What happens to the women and, in some cases, girls, children, 9 years old? What happens to them once they're marked as a rape victim?
Well, there's a real strong tribal sense of honor here. And if women are touched, even if they're abducted and they're not raped, people feel like their family name has been stained. And so the women's ordeal doesn't stop with the rape or the abduction. It continues very often when they come back to their families, you know, who beat them, who ostracized them, and in some instances kill them.
And as you said, it is hard to quantify, but is there a sense that some of these rapes are somehow post-war or because of war?
Well, there's a sense that they're post-war because if you recall, before the war, months before the war, Saddam released a whole bunch of criminals from the prisons in Iraq. And then after the war, you had police stations that were looted. The American military presence wasn't focused on protecting civilians as much. And so, you know, these become crimes of opportunity. And women in Baghdad are used to being out and about, and they're a big part of society and the economic life here. And that really changed right after the war. They're coming back out more now, but only to do the most essential things, go to work, come home, go to school, come home. And when they go to school, their parents are waiting for them to pick them up, take them to school.
We had done reports predicting this, that Iraq would be a much more dangerous place for women post-war.
I think that this is part of the broader imperative for the coalition forces and the Iraqi police to improve security on ground level as soon as possible. And it's small things, too, like having the streets lighted. I mean, electricity is so erratic in Baghdad, and who wants to walk dark streets. It gets dark around 8:30 at night.
Any sense that with all the needs that Baghdad and Iraq has right now for electricity, for food, that there's going to be any effort put into, you know, shelter for rape victims?
I hate to say it, but I don't think so. I think the outlook in the meantime is quite bleak as far as the particular needs of women who've been raped, women who've been abducted, women who are being sold in human trafficking. There's so many other concerns, and men mostly are setting the agenda.
Well, Neela, thank you.
You're welcome.
Neela Banerjee, correspondent for The New York Times in Baghdad. Well, as we mentioned, CIA Director George Tenet is expected to testify before the Senate today about intelligence leading to the war in Iraq. We turn now to Faye Bowers of the Christian Science Monitor. And Faye, what do you think is expected to happen in that closed-door meeting?
I think George Tenet will go over the national intelligence estimate that now has become so infamous, and those 16 words that were included in the president's speech about obtaining yellow cake uranium from Niger, and present what it is exactly, the kinds of statements and what evidence they had to back up their statements to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Will he lose his job?
I don't think so. Most of the people I speak with say no, that he's done exactly as he should be doing.
In that
he provided the information, he urged them not to use that information in the way that they used it, the administration officials, that is to say, mm-hmm. and that he pointed out the caveats, the qualifiers to the information that they had.
Well, Faye, in a related topic, Senator Ted Kennedy fired quite a broadside in a speech yesterday that he made at Johns Hopkins University, saying that the Bush administration was making U.S. troops in Iraq sitting ducks. He's also looking to file some legislation today to force the Bush administration to come up with a plan, and asking, you know, other Democrats to call the president to task. Your sense of his speech and how it's being received in Washington?
Being received quite well from what I can see. I mean, he has got broad bipartisan support and respect among both senators and congresspeople alike. And I think, there's sort of a momentum going now for public discussion about what's going on in Iraq, about the numbers of casualties, about the chaos there, and about the cost, and that things don't seem to be getting better. They're getting worse by the day. There are more and more complaints among the troops. There are more and more casualties every day, and there's more and more chaos every day, and more anger expressed by Iraqi people about American occupation there.
Whereas previously questioning any policy was considered unpatriotic.
Exactly. And I think that has started to change.
Faye, thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Faye Bowers writes for the Christian Science Monitor.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair arrives in Washington tomorrow to address a joint session of Congress and to meet with President Bush. Now, when the trip was first planned, it was to have been a victory lap, and Blair was to have been given a Congressional Gold Medal, the first Briton to be so honored since Winston Churchill. Now, the award's been canceled, or at least postponed. Reports say because of fear it would play badly back in Britain. So amid simmering differences between the U.S. and Britain over intelligence claims on Iraq and over the treatment of British prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, Tony Blair arrives for a very different visit than he may have first imagined. Hugo Young is a political commentator with The Guardian newspaper. He joins us from London. And welcome, Hugo.
Good to be here.
Hugo, thanks for joining us. A gold medal, a congressional gold medal, at least postponed, because that will not play well back home. You know, over here, Tony Blair is still generally well regarded. How is he doing back home?
Well, back home, he's doing worse and worse, I would say. The war, of course, was in its way a success. But first of all, we always had a very large body of people who were against the war. And subsequently, in all the confusions about why we went to war, his particular explanation for that, all the concentration on weapons of mass destruction, which have not yet been found, have all added to a sense that Blair is no longer the figure he was.
Well, what does it say about the special relationship that a prime minister receiving a Congressional Gold Medal would not play well back in Britain?
I think it says quite a lot. I think it reminds one that the special relationship has always been, and certainly is now, something which is confined to the political classes in both countries. It's certainly not the felt experience, shall we say, of very many British people. And I think that the sense now among the Labour voters, the sense of him consorting with, and in their eyes at least, being something of a lapdog to a neoconservative American president, does not sit well.
Well, the White House here, as you know, of course, has backed away from its claim that Iraq was trying to purchase uranium from Niger. What is Tony Blair saying about all that at this point?
Well, Tony Blair and his colleagues are still sticking stubbornly by the claim that they had separate intelligence information which confirmed to them that Iraq was trying to get uranium from Niger. And this is an interesting break with what we think of as the Anglo-American relationship, because we had thought all intelligence was shared between them.
Yeah.
The whole business about this uranium has shown, first of all, extraordinary amount of sort of people acting across purposes and people not trusting each other with each other's intelligence.
Another issue, of course, that's certainly going to be raised between the two leaders is the return of those British citizens who are being held at the U.S. military base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There are two of them now scheduled to appear before military tribunals. Now, what has Blair said publicly about that so far, and what is he likely to say to the president about that?
Blair has said publicly that he hopes there will be, and indeed expects there to be, a fair trial. He's made no public commitment to make heavier demands on the U.S. to return the two Brits for trial here. I think with Bush, he will in private say much more about the real political difficulty he will be in if he has to watch two British citizens being tried by this pretty draconian court system which has been set up to deal with the people in Guantanamo. How much ice that will cut, we'll see.
But doesn't Prime Minister Blair, either on this issue of the prisoners or some other issue, given all we've talked about, have to put some more daylight between him and the President of the United States?
Well, people like me have been arguing that for quite some time, and I think that either Blair has to get something from Bush, which at the moment looks rather unlikely, or he does need to separate himself a bit more from the American position.
If the Prime Minister gets nothing or very little, is his leadership position endangered?
I think it's weakened. I don't, on the whole, think that it would be endangered, because I think that there are still a lot of people in the Labour Party who, if for no other reason than winning the next election, will continue to see Blair as their best asset. I mean, he has won two enormous election victories.
Yeah.
He is a very good election campaigner. Between now and the election, much water will flow. But I think he will be weakened. I think he will never again see this leader who used to really dominate his party and the country. He would always be seen with a more jaundiced eye, and therefore his ambitions will always be curtailed, I think, by this lingering sense of mistrust.
Hugo Young, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure to be there.
Hugo Young is the political commentator with the British newspaper The Guardian. He spoke to us from London.
This update of a story we reported earlier in the week, Eliyahu Goral, the Israeli cab driver who had been kidnapped by Palestinians, was freed yesterday in a dramatic rescue by Israeli commandos. The driver's rescue followed the arrest of two of his kidnappers, and according to Israeli radio, the investigation into the abduction was aided by the Palestinian Authority. Israeli television also reported that Goral's captors had sought to turn him over to a militant Palestinian group, but got no takers. The case is being seen as an encouraging sign of cooperation between Israel and the Palestinian Authority.
Just ahead, we talk with first-time novelist Jonathan Safran Foer about his best-selling book, Everything is Illuminated, now out in paperback.
And later, a truce is declared between the architect and developer of the World Trade Center site. But what does that mean for the dramatic design?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
You've probably heard the story. 2.5 years ago, 24-year-old Jonathan Safran Foer was a name only his college professors and a few people in literary circles knew. But then the New Yorker magazine published an excerpt from Foer's debut novel, Everything is Illuminated. And everything was, well, illuminated. Last summer, the book appeared almost everywhere, including the coveted spot on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. And now the book is out in paperback, getting even more praise and press. A year ago, Jonathan Safran Foer stopped by our studios to talk about his then newfound fame in the literary world.
I've gotten a number of letters in the mail from people, and almost uniformly they begin with, I wanted to hate your book, or I was tired of hearing about your book. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people come to the book with that feeling.
Yeah, so what was it, this sort of jealousy or envy or...
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the letters come from young writers, people who are in the same position I was in a couple years ago when I would write letters.
Mm. Would you? Who'd you write to?
I would write to everybody. Musicians, there's this guy, Stephen Malcolmus, the lead singer of a band, Pavement, that I love. I wrote to a woman, Helen DeWitt. Not only would I write, I would make little gifts, like put things in little cases with pieces of paper that were in different envelopes and keys and locks and stuff like that.
You were like a stalker.
Yeah.
Why? Because what? You wanted to have what they had? You wanted to admire them?
I think it had much less to do with me and them than it did with the communication itself and how wonderful it feels to pack something up for somebody and how wonderful it feels to unpack something from somebody. And frankly, it's at the heart of, you know, writing.
I was just going to say, is that what a book is?
Yeah. I sometimes think of a good book as like a table over which two people can talk.
Which, in fact, is maybe what it's like, but in your case, it's what it is. It's a kind of a dialogue and exchange between your two main characters. Mm. It's sort of two separate books running parallel. As each of them, Alex, the wacky Ukrainian translator, and Jonathan, the hero, as he's called by Alex, each tell this story of their journey. Actually, you know what? I'd love for us to hear a little bit of that for those, you know, who haven't read the book and have only heard about it.
Okay. Well, I can start right at the beginning, actually. As you were saying, the book is told from two very different places, the first of which is a translator, Alexander Perchov, a young Ukrainian who has been given the assignment to take this young American, Jonathan Safran Foer, on the trip as he goes to try to find the town his grandfather came from. And so he's our guide through about half of the book. And he's also this sort of the sympathetic heart of the book. He begins sounding like a real fool and I think ends up sounding like the real hero. And I'll just read his first paragraph and, you know, keep in mind as you listen that he doesn't speak very good English.
And he's a translator.
Right. My legal name is Alexander Perchov, but all of my many friends dub me Alex, because that is a more flaccid-to-utter version of my legal name. Mother dubs me Alexei Stop Spleening Me, because I'm always spleening her. If you want to know why I am always spleening her, it's because I'm always elsewhere with friends and disseminating so much currency and performing so many things that can spleen a mother. Father used to dub me Shapka for the fur hat that I would don, even in the summer month. He ceased dubbing me that because I ordered him to cease dubbing me that. It sounded very boyish to me, and I've always thought of myself as potent and generative. So this is our guide, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
Yeah, both. Both. Yeah. What's the spleening?
God, if I had a nickel for everyone who has asked me that. And it's funny, you know, the strange thing about writing a book is that the things you think are clear are often the things that are most unclear, and the things that you didn't intend are sometimes the things that really, you know, drive the point home farthest. What you do has almost nothing in common with what is done, if that makes sense.
You mean perception-wise?
Well, yeah.
What was one of the ones you had, and what's one of the perceptions you've gotten back?
Oh, an issue that has come up a lot, actually, is this question of whether or not Alex is gay. It wasn't really something I thought about very seriously when I wrote the book.
Really? I don't hear that at all. I just thought of him as happy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't.
Well, he said there are a couple lines that people cling to. Like in one part, he says, if my father knew how I desire to love and whom I desire to love, he would kill me. Okay, that doesn't really mean anything, but it's something that I put in and other people have read in a way that I didn't necessarily intend. It's not... I mean, the other interesting thing is that then when I hear these interpretations sent back to me, even if it wasn't what I intended, I don't disagree usually. I think in a lot of cases, oh, that's viable. That makes sense to me. Hmm. And you just thank you for making my book better, you know, for giving my book an additional meaning that I couldn't have given it on my own.
Hmm. How weird is it to have this other character be you?
Well, it's a little hard for me to say it's weird because I did it. I made a trip very much like the trip in the book where I had a photograph of a woman who I'd been told saved my grandfather from the Nazis. And I went to the Ukraine for 3 days looking for this woman.
Hmm. Well, young man, here you are, as I was saying. I mean, everywhere you look, you hear your name mentioned. Do you feel that?
You know, I feel that people tell me that occasionally. It's something I've never experienced on my own. I mean, it's the really wonderful thing about writing, in a way, is that you can never expect or anticipate or even hope for anything resembling real celebrity or fame. Every writer, with the possible exception of Salman Rushdie, can carry on his or her life exactly mm-hmm. as he or she wants.
Well, and there's the other side to it, which is that you run the danger of everyone talking about you and maybe not reading you. We started off by saying that you made the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and then you made the back page where they have the comic, I've got it here,
yeah.
where it's panel after panel after panel of couples talking in a bookstore about quite something that everything illuminated. Hard to believe, it's first novel. Yes, that Alex character was a scream. And they go on and on talking about it. And the gist of it is that not one of these people has actually read the book.
yeah. This is what keeps me awake at night every now and again. But let's assume everyone will get around to it anyway.
Jonathan, it is a terrific read. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
And now you have another opportunity. Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Everything is Illuminated, is now out in paperback.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, two studies with interesting results. One shows that when medical residents work with little sleep, they're about as sharp as when they're a little drunk.
The other study suggests that kids who spend more time in daycare are more aggressive and disobedient. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, what happens when you build a shopping center and no one goes there anymore? A movement to reclaim dead malls.
The ones that we're most excited about are the ones where the malls are being converted back into more traditional neighborhoods with streets that pass right through them and connect up with the surrounding community.
And poet Martín Espada reads from his new poem, Alabanza, dedicated to the employees of Windows on the World who lost their lives on 9/11.
Praise the busboy's music, the chime of his dishes and silverware in the tub, Alabanza.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. There were more deadly attacks in Iraq today against U.S. troops and Iraqis working with the U.S. A pro-American mayor of a western Iraqi city was shot and killed, along with his 8-year-old son. The Arab satellite network, Al Jazeera, says the mayor's car was shot up by attackers as he drove through the city about 150 miles northwest of Baghdad. And a deadly grenade attack on a U.S. soldier brings the total number of combat deaths to 147. That equals the total in the 1991 Gulf War. CIA Director George Tenet testifies before a closed-door congressional hearing today amid the continuing dispute over faulty intelligence used in the president's State of the Union address. Tenet says he was responsible for a claim in the speech that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger, which turned out to be false. Democrats are pressing for an open investigation into pre-war intelligence. A Virginia judge has ruled that the case of sniper suspect John Mohammed will be moved 200 miles away to Virginia Beach to ensure a fair and impartial trial. The AP's Mark Barakat says both the defense and prosecution have agreed to the move.
Defense attorneys had given some good cause that all the residents of Prince William County could be considered potential victims of the sniper spree because of, I guess, the wave of fear that sort of gripped the area.
John Mohammed and fellow suspect Lee Malvo are accused of terrorizing Washington, D.C. and its suburbs with a fatal shooting rampage last October. A published report says the astronauts on the Space Shuttle Columbia lived for almost 1 minute after NASA lost communication with them. The New York Times is citing investigators who've been examining an onboard sensor recording system that kept working far into the shuttle's breakup on February 1st. Officials say the crew capsule would have been severely buffeted, and the astronauts were aware of sensor readings showing major problems. One out of 10 Europeans with HIV has a strain of the virus resistant to at least one kind of AIDS drug. This according to the first large-scale study of its kind. Scientists say they've long known that the virus can become resistant, but they did not know the extent of it. The results were presented today at a meeting of the International AIDS Society. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 57 points at 9072. The Nasdaq is down 9 points at 1744.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
New York Governor George Pataki's aggressive timeline for rebuilding on Ground Zero is forcing two men to settle their differences sooner rather than later. Daniel Libeskind, the architect with the winning design for the World Trade Center, is pushing to keep his spiral of five towers design intact. But developer Larry Silverstein argues that Libeskind's design might hinder the project's commercial viability. And the governor says the project must break ground in a year or else. With the update on a rebuilding meeting yesterday, we turn to New York Times reporter Edward Wyatt. And Edward, remind us, many people can picture Mr. Libeskind's design, the towers with the beautiful, almost 2,000-foot spire and the memorial underneath. What are the differences between the architect and the developer?
Well, the developer, Larry Silverstein, wants to do several things. Because the what they are calling the Freedom Tower, the 1,776-foot tower, will be the first thing built and maybe the only commercial building built for several years. He wants to move it closer to the transportation hub that's being built. And for engineering reasons, he wants to change the design a little to put the spire rather than have it on the side of the building where Daniel Libeskind has designed it. He wants to put it more centered over the building, which would make it less expensive to build.
Well, and in your opinion, how much would it change the actual design itself?
I think that it would change the design because of the spiral effect that Daniel Libeskind has. He contends that if you move it to a different part of the site, you won't get the same flow of buildings that he intended to mimic the kind of spiral of the Statue of Liberty. If you look at the design, it's a definite sweep around the memorial site on the World Trade Center property to this towering spire looking out over the harbor.
Well, Mr. Libeskind had the design, but developer Silverstein has the money, right?
Yes, he has the money, which is why the governor gave him the reins to get the building built. And that's very important because Larry Silverstein knows what he wants. He knows what commercial customers want. Daniel Libeskind has never designed a skyscraper. And so while the aesthetics of the project are important, Larry Silverstein ultimately has to rent the buildings.
What decisions were made, if any, at the meeting that was held yesterday to try to put together these two men?
Well, they reached an agreement after an 8-hour negotiating session. And what was decided was that Daniel Libeskind will collaborate with David Childs, who is the architect hired by Larry Silverstein. But from the way they described it, it sounds like David Childs will have the last word, which means that Larry Silverstein is more likely to get more of what he wants than perhaps Mr. Libeskind will on this particular building.
Can you just give us a sense of how New Yorkers are feeling about this? Is there just a sense of let's just get it built and cover the space? Or is there a sense that Mr. Libeskind's being treated unfairly? Can you get a sense of public reaction?
I think in everyone's mind, the most important aspect of the project is the memorial, which is not changing and, you know, which is undergoing the competition now to design the memorial within the site that Daniel Libeskind has prepared. So I'm not sure everyone is really caught up in exactly what the building is going to look like. And most people, I think, need to see something, some drawings at least, before they can react to it.
And this being New York, there's not going to be one opinion anyway.
Exactly.
Edward Wyatt, thank you.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Edward Wyatt speaking to us from New York.
On the list of endangered species, maybe, your local mall. You know, that temple of perpetual muzak, where consuming is the religious experience. But as retailers hightail it to mega malls and even back downtown, what's left behind are dead malls, ghostly shadows of their former selves, often on immense parcels of land, which is why some are now wondering what to do with all that space. Among projects planned, stocking old malls with office space, transforming them into residential neighborhoods, and there are even back-to-nature schemes. Joining us on the line now to discuss all this is Stephen Bodzin from the Congress for the New Urbanism in San Francisco. And welcome, Steve.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Steve, what's the main reason malls are going extinct, if you will?
Well, there's been a couple of major changes. One is that these malls aren't built to last. They're built for about a 20-year lifespan, and then unless the owner puts a lot of money in and a lot of energy, they tend to decline just because that's the way that they're built. There are changes in what people are looking for in a shopping experience. There's changes in the neighborhoods around them. There's changes in the transportation system. All of those can strand an older mall and leave it really with nowhere to go. It's not like a traditional downtown that can evolve and change as times change.
That's almost poignant, not quite, a stranded mall. What kind of numbers are we looking at? How many are becoming obsolete?
Well, about 4 years ago, we contracted with PricewaterhouseCoopers to look into that, and they found that about 10% of the malls around the country are already, well, they already have low enough sales figures that you could call them dead or grayfield malls. There's about another 10% that are in pretty rough shape and are likely to become grayfield or dead malls unless they get major investment from the owners.
So we're talking about hundreds of malls, thousands?
It's probably hundreds.
Hundreds.
It depends on how you measure, but there's really only a few thousand malls of this size in the country. We were only looking at regional malls.
So what are some of the projects, Steve, that people have come up with to do something with these gray fields?
The ones that we're most excited about are the ones where the malls are being converted back into more traditional neighborhoods. with streets that pass right through them and connect up with the surrounding community, blocks of housing and office and retail space, regular parks.
Now, basically, that means tearing the old mall down, right, or not?
It depends. In most situations, the mall does get destroyed almost completely. There are a couple of situations, like there's one in Pasadena, California, where the mall was largely left intact, but the what used to be corridors became streets, regular streets with people walking on them and even cars driving down them, but a large part of the building still stands.
Now, what about these back-to-nature schemes?
The one that I'm most familiar with is in St. Paul, Minnesota, where a smaller mall was built on the site of a former lake, and they had flooding problems, and so they decided that it was probably worth it to just go with the flow, as it were, and revert some of the parking lot to the lake that used to be there. They put a small park around that, and they're doing more intensive development adjacent to that, where there used to be the mall, some parking lots, and some low-density development.
So malls are not quite at the point where drive-in movie theaters were not so long ago.
Probably not, although certainly the big, huge power centers with their big box stores and these neighborhood-scale shopping centers are certainly taking a larger and larger part of the market.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Steve Bodson, thanks very much for joining us on this.
All right. It's good talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Steve Bodson from the Congress for the New Urbanism in San Francisco. He joined us from San Francisco.
Still to come, poet Martina Spada reading from his new poem, Alabanza, dedicated to the employees of Windows on the World who lost their lives on 9/11.
You're listening to Here and Now. Sea Island, Georgia's always attracted an elite crowd. Big-time movie stars and politicians retreat there, where the 500 or so private homes are typically called cottages and typically run in the very uncottagey price range of $1 million or so. Former President George Bush and his wife Barbara spent their honeymoon on Sea Island. Well, now the place's peace is going to be thrown into something of an uproar, because Sea Island's been chosen to host the 2004 G8 Summit, 3 days of big think about the world's problems that may bring Sea Island big problems, too. Well, to learn more about Sea Island and the G8, we're joined now by Bill Jones III. He's the chairman and CEO of the Sea Island Company, which owns the Cloister Hotel, where the summit will take place. And welcome, Bill.
Good afternoon.
Bill, first, congratulations.
Thank you. We are, needless to say, thrilled and excited with the opportunity to host the GA.
Well, that's great. Paint us a picture of Sea Island. What's the place look like?
Well, Sea Island is a beautiful, relatively secluded island off the coast of Georgia with moss-draped oaks and the warm breezes of the Atlantic Ocean. It's a place of great natural beauty.
How far out to sea are you?
We're about 5 miles off the coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the question, of course, that looms is security, first off. G8 summits tend to attract protesters, as you well know. Some of them have turned violent in the past. And, of course, we live in times stained by terrorism. What about all that?
Well, we know that there'll be monumental security issues related to the summit, but, you know, we also live in a land of freedom, and protesters have their place at events like this, and they'll be welcome on the coast of Georgia as well.
Yeah.
And we'll just leave that up to the professionals to handle how they handle it.
Welcome on the coast of Georgia.
That's correct.
Not on the island.
I'm sure that the government will set aside the appropriate space for the protesters, and I would doubt that it would be here on the island.
I see. Now, how much does the government tell a guy like you about what their plans are for security?
Well, I think they'll tell us everything we need to know. There's an awful lot of unknown right now. We just found out yesterday that we had been selected, and we'll learn a lot more as the days go on.
Now, Bill, you bid for this?
No, we don't bid for it. The government has a team that they put together to evaluate sites, and they came and visited here first this past spring, and I've been back several times, and we just put our best face forward, and we're fortunate enough to have been selected.
Yeah. Now, what's it going to cost you in the 11 months or so until next June when the G8 summit happens, and who pays for the preparations for something like
that? Well, a lot of the preparations will be paid by the federal government.
Uh-huh.
It'll be For instance, security is a federal government responsibility, and we don't know what the financial cost will be to us in the preparations. We know there'll be a lot of time and energy and effort, but we're committed to making this the finest summit ever.
Yeah. Sea Island's already a very wonderful place. You have no problem attracting people to your beautiful island. Why is it a good thing to have a G8 there?
Oh, I think the publicity of a G8 summit is unparalleled. Mm. And, the international coverage we'll receive is great and welcome.
How are people on the island reacting to all this, including some of the residents who live in those cottages?
Frankly, everybody's very excited and thrilled. People recognize that there'll be some inconvenience associated with it, but people are thrilled to have the leaders of the 8 largest countries in the world visiting our backyard.
Anybody a little nervous?
All of us are a little nervous. But we're also confident that we can do a great job and that President Bush will be proud when the event's over.
Well, Bill Jones, thank you very much for joining us from Sea Island.
Thank you very much.
Bill Jones III is the chairman and CEO of the Sea Island Company, and he joined us from Sea Island, Georgia.
There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a poetic tribute to the workers of the Windows on the World restaurant in the World Trade Center. But first, after the awfulness of September 11th, the 300 or so surviving employees of Windows on the World struggled to find new jobs in an ailing industry. About half are still looking, but now 43 have decided to employ themselves. They hope to open a cooperative restaurant in Lower Manhattan next spring, and they're raising money through catering and fundraisers. Joining us on the line from New York City is Mohammed Shamim. He's a former banquet waiter at Windows on the World. He hopes to be a part of the new restaurant. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
And I understand that the new restaurant that's being considered will be a cooperative, a restaurant where you and the other workers would have part ownership in the restaurant.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, this is a pretty ambitious undertaking. I think there's one other restaurant in Ohio that has this, a major cooperative restaurant.
Yes, it's Athens, Ohio.
Yeah. What will this mean for you to have this opportunity?
Well, it means a lot more because mm-hmm. we used to work for a big rich people, mm-hmm. and now we're trying to do something ourselves.
I would imagine that those of you who worked at Windows on the World,
there's other restaurants or employee also involved. Like, example, is a Vista restaurant. It was hotel. It was next to us, World Trade Center. They are also involved with this cooperative.
But I guess that's my point. I mean, I would think that those of you who were there that day or who worked in that restaurant and lost friends on 9/11, I would imagine that you have an incredible bond.
Yeah. Actually, we're trying to keep our all the people who used to work in the Windows together, plus we used to keep Windows name with the 9/11, plus that's the way we could remember our those friends who died in the World Trade Center.
Yeah. You know, it's very hard to keep a restaurant going in New York. It's a tough town.
Yes, very tough town, a very tough time also. This is the economic is not too good, but still we're trying to keep it up. If everybody put their effort, 100% effort, it is very easy to do it. And now I find out myself.
Well, we wish you a lot of luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Mohammed Shamim is a former banquet waiter at the Windows on the World restaurant, joining other former Windows employees who plan to open a restaurant in Lower Manhattan next spring. Well, for the past 20 years, Puerto Rican-American poet Martin Espada has written for such men and women, people he says are invisible, forgotten. In his new book, Alabanza, New and Selected Poems, 1982-2002, Espada includes a poem dedicated to the restaurant workers of Windows on the World.
Recently, Martina Spada met with Here Now producer April Peavy at a coffee house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to talk about Alabanza, the book, the poem, and the meaning of the word.
Literally, alabanza means praise in Spanish, and I had the opportunity to use it not only as the title of a poem, but as the title of this new book.
We'll get to that poem, Alabanza, shortly, but what came to mind when I was reading your book is the phrase, let us now praise famous men.
I think I may have been aware of that phrase at some level because I remember that book. Let us now praise famous men certainly makes sense to me because many of the poems in this collection are all about the faceless and the voiceless. I am, in these poems, acting as an advocate, speaking on behalf of those without an opportunity to be heard.
Introduce me to one of your characters in your book.
Here's a poem that goes right to the heart of what we are talking about. It's written in the voice of a janitor by the name of Jorge. And like Jorge, who is a real person, I experienced a certain dilemma, what I call the dilemma of the thinking janitor. What happens if you have a voice and a mind, and they work, but you're only seen for what your hands can clean up. So here's the poem that came out of it in the voice of Jorge. It's called Jorge the Church Janitor Finally Quits. No one asks where I am from. I must be from the country of janitors. I have always mopped this floor. Honduras, you are a squatter's camp outside the city of their understanding. No one can speak my name. I host the fiesta of the bathroom, stirring the toilet like a punch bowl. The Spanish music of my name is lost when the guests complain about toilet paper. What they say must be true. I am smart, but I have a bad attitude. No one knows that I quit tonight. Maybe the mop will push on without me, sniffing along the floor like a crazy squid with stringy gray tentacles. They will call it Jorge.
What do you want your poems to say to people?
I want the poem to move people, and I want people to be engaged on the level of the senses. I hope the poetry makes people think. I know the poems have made people argue. Sometimes people like the poem, sometimes they don't. It's okay as long as the poem creates some kind of response.
Getting back to the title of your book, Alabanza, it's the title of the very last poem in this collection, and it's a poem dedicated to, well, you tell me.
Well, it's a poem dedicated to the food service workers who were killed at the World Trade Center on 9/11. One of the things that stuck with me in the aftermath of the 9/11 tragedy was that there were some people who had literally vanished without a trace. Cooks, busboys, waiters, what have you. Many of them Puerto Rican, many of them Latino, many of them undocumented. So I'll read this poem now. And it is called Alabanza in Praise of Local 100. Alabanza. Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye, a blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white to worship the dark saint of the sea. Alabanza. Praise the cook's yellow pirate's cap worn in the name of Roberto Clemente, his plane that flamed into the ocean loaded with cans for Nicaragua, for all the mouths chewing the ash of earthquakes. Alabanza. Praise the kitchen radio, dial clicked even before the dial on the oven so that music and Spanish rose before bread. Praise the bread. Alabanza. Praise Manhattan from 107 flights up, like Atlantis glimpsed through the windows of an ancient aquarium. Praise the great windows where immigrants from the kitchen could squint and almost see their world. Hear the chant of nations, Ecuador, Mexico, República Dominicana, Haiti, Yemen, Ghana, Bangladesh, Alabanza. Praise the kitchen in the morning, where the gas burned blue on every stove and exhaust fans fired their diminutive propellers, hands cracked eggs with quick thumbs, or sliced open cartons to build an altar of cans. Alabanza. Praise the busboy's music, the chime of his dishes, and silverware in the tub. Alabanza. praised the dish dog, the dishwasher who worked that morning because another dishwasher could not stop coughing or because he needed overtime to pile the sacks of rice and beans for a family floating away on some Caribbean island plagued by frogs. Alabanza. Praise the waitress who heard the radio in the kitchen and sang to herself about a man gone. Alabanza. After the thunder, wilder than thunder. After the shutter deep in the glass of the great windows. After the radio stopped singing like a tree full of terrified frogs. After night burst the dam of day and flooded the kitchen. For a time the stoves glowed in darkness like the lighthouse in Fajardo, like a cook's soul. Soul, I say, even if the dead cannot tell us about the bristles of God's beard, because God has no face. Soul, I say, to name the smoke beings flung in constellations across the night sky of this city and cities to come. Alabanza, I say, even if God has no face. Alabanza. When the war began, from Manhattan and Kabul, two constellations of smoke rose and drifted to each other, mingling in icy air, and one said with an Afghan tongue, "Teach me to dance, we have no music here." And the other said with a Spanish tongue, "I will teach you, music is all we have."
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Poet Martina Spada and his poem dedicated to the windows on the world workers. For more information on Alabanza, new and selected poems 1982-2002, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the new... I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the new...